Aye.
Court, Mr. Jim Perdue and Mr. Kevin DuBose, who is that argument in petition?
May it please this honorable court, I'm Jim Perdue, attorney for petitioner in this case, along my co-counsel, Mr. Kevin DuBose. We plan to split our time roughly evenly, but if I don't use my full time, I would like to assign whatever is left over to Mr. DuBose for the remainder so that we have the opportunity to use the full 30 minutes should we need it. This case presents to the court, we think, a significant issue, which can be simply stated, and that is, should Texas courts recognize an implied warranty that all services should be performed in a good and workmanlike manner? I would like to take a few moments to address the question of the concept of implied warranties from a historical and legal perspective, and then have Mr. DuBose direct the court's attention to the facts of the case which bring it before the court, because he is much more familiar with it, having handled it in the intermediate appellate level and having worked on the case for some time. As this court knows, the concern over consumer protection found its genesis in the legislature with the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Since that time, this court has directed its attention to various problems of implied warranties. Some of the members of the court are probably as old as I am, if not older, and may remember that we had a place down in Houston, two blocks past the Pierce Elevator, back in 1957-58, in which wrecked cars were taken, cars that had been totally wrecked. That place, they would take the cars, they would fix them up, try to re-straighten the frames, they'd take them down the street two blocks, and then they'd sell them as used cars, full financing, for a regular price. The purchaser didn't realize he was buying a wrecked car. And the people that those kind of folks preyed on in those days were always the young black trying to get started, the young Hispanic family trying to make a living on a meager wage, people like that. It were those kind of situations that gave rise to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and similar legislation. Now, insofar as implied warranties are concerned, of course, this court began with Decker in 42 in a food case, which really doesn't apply much to our situation, and then in Humber in 1968 with a warranty of workmanlike performance on a new home. And this court recognized implied warranty in that situation. This court went 17 years, as near as I can tell, without writing directly on the issue of implied warranties, although our intermediate courts were writing on the issue involving service transactions, and this court was NREing those cases in many instances. In 1985, in Evans versus Stiles, this court, without hearing oral argument, elaborated upon Humber and indicated that in a new house transaction, these warranties applied not only to the goods, but to the services of the house of a good and workmanlike performance. Then in Melody Homes, this court wrote an opinion, and I'm going to refer to them, if I may, as Melody Homes 1, Melody Homes 2, since the original opinion was withdrawn. In Melody Homes 1, this court wrote an opinion declaring that the court was recognizing for this state an implied warranty that would extend to all services for a good and workmanlike performance. In so doing, this court expressly overruled the case I want to talk about briefly in just a bit, and that was Dennis versus Allison. Then in Melody Homes 2, the court on rehearing withdrew that language extending the warranty to all services and withdrawing the language overruling that overruled Dennis versus Allison. And as I read Melody Homes versus 2, the court said that they were recognizing at this time an implied warranty of repair on tangible goods only, but was reserving for future cases the question of an implied warranty as extended to other services, and in this case, as we submit, all services. Now, since in Melody Homes, in the second opinion, this court said in the majority opinion, the court's decision, that implied warranties arise by operation of law when public policy mandates. I would like to take a few moments to talk about why public policy mandates the recognition of those kind of implied warranties. The court recognized that in Melody Holmes, and there have been a number of law review articles written about it. These aren't necessarily along the lines. Lawyers are great plagiarizers, and I'm probably one of the best. And I have plagiarized some of the concepts, but perhaps viewed them in a little different way. The first reason is that the failure to recognize an implied warranty for fitness of services rewards the wrong people. It rewards the shoddy workman, it rewards the sloppy repairman, it rewards the mediocre contractor, it rewards the amateurish consultant, it rewards the blundering blue-collar professional, it rewards the fourth-rate professional.
Isn't that why we have a remedy for contract and negligence?
Your Honor, those are limited remedies, and I will address that. And the facts of this case, I think, demonstrate why those remedies, as all remedies, have their limitations. And they had their limitation in the facts of this case, and it's why we need to recognize this as a remedy. Certainly there are other remedies. They have their limitations. They do not give the protection that is needed to protect against this type of situation. The failure to recognize an implied warranty of fitness for services penalizes the good worker, the responsible repairman, the conscientious contractor, the scrupulous, able, and adept professional. The underlying basis of the concept of implied warranty is a simple concept that individuals of a calling, whether it's a professional calling or a non-professional calling, should be liable for failing to perform as one in their trade ought to. The imposition of implied warranty, as this court has already pointed out, is not a guarantee of result. It is simply a guarantee of performance. The recognition of the difference between the purchaser of services and the seller and supplier of services is another relevant consideration. If I have trouble with the electricity at my house, and I need an electrician, if I'm a skilled electrician, I can fix it myself, and a lot of people do. But if I know nothing about electricity, I've got to call somebody. Why? Because I don't know anything about it. And that's why we call upon both professionals and non-professionals to do things that we can't do for ourselves. And so in the implied warranty situation that we're talking about, there is reliance on the part of the consumer and there is profit on the part of the deliverer of services. He's in the business, he's selected, the plaintiff chooses him, the consumer chooses him because supposedly not only is he skillful, the implied warranty says that there are two things. He is skillful and he will carry out his work in a skillful and careful and ordinarily, and we even get into the question as in Dennis versus Allison, ethical way. Now what is the present posture of the law in this state? The present posture is that we have a body of law now that is a result of unpurposed happenstance because of cases that have come before the court. We now, by way of judicial precedent, recognize that the purchaser of a new home and the purchaser of repair services rendered on tangible goods are entitled to the protection of an implied warranty, but nobody else is. It's a crazy quilt that warms few and leaves many cold.
Counsel, let me ask you something. Have already pointed out the struggle this court had with respect to professional services. And in the end, when rehearing, we limited the holding to the facts before us at that time and left the question of professional services open. If this court were to impose what appears to be the requirement of the DTPA on professional services, that they be performed, that there's a warranty that they be performed in a good workmanlike manner, how long do you think it'd be before the legislature would repeal the act? 6 months, a year, special session?
Honor, I'm not...
I know you can't answer that. Let me ask it another way.
That would be...
Did you see any of the amicus briefs that were filed with this court?
I have, Your Honor.
On rehearing in the Melody Homes?
I have.
Did you notice all the different professional groups that says you can't judge us by the result when we render professional services? Otherwise, lawyers would be penalized for breach of warranty under the Deceptive Trade Practice Act for failure to achieve a result that a jury was going to determine.
I have a hard time following the logic of the arguments that are presented there, Your Honor. Because this court has pointed out we're not talking about...
Well, irrespective of its logic, can you give me an answer to it?
To the concern over by professional groups?
Yes. Doctors, for example, are lawyers, that they don't achieve a result. Is a jury going to say that the fact that they did not achieve the result that was desired, a breach of warranty, of good workmanlike manner?
Justice Spears, you've known me long enough that I'm going to be pretty candid, and I'm going
to
say some things that some people won't like. But I'll tell you, in my opinion, a lot of the professional groups, and I've dealt, as you know, with medical situations more than any others, a lot of the professional groups serve, in my judgment, to protect mediocre deliverance of services more than they do to promote the deliverance of adequate services. That's my perspective, and I don't ask the court or anyone else to agree with it, but I think there's a lot of that goes into it. The competent lawyer has no fear of the kind of rule we're proposing. In fact, it's only fair. A lawyer as good as Joe Reynolds, he's got no fear of a rule like this. One of the finest lawyers in the state. I find it an enigma that he's arguing for the other side in this case, because we've got one of the finest lawyers arguing that lawyers ought not be held for that standard.
Are we going to be asking jurors, though, that the professional made a wrong decision in representing a client or in building a building as an architect?
No, we're going to be asking...
Or in treating a disease as a doctor without a negligence standard? Just wasn't good in workmanlike manner?
But, Your Honor, as the court pointed out in Melody Holmes was a simple situation. A guy goes to repair a dishwasher and he doesn't repair it, and this court pointed out you don't need an expert. Now, most of these professional situations, you're going to have expert testimony, which is going to make a difference.
Mr. Perdue.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
When you're trying a lawsuit, you know what your evidence is, and you know where it's weak, and you're called on to make a judgment call as to whether or not you're going to put this witness on, whether or not you're going to get into a certain area and cross-examination of the other person's witness, and the lawyer's got to make a decision and live by it. Now, in hindsight, he could very well have made a bad mistake. We saw that happen in Houston in the last year. A big mistake. Now, are we going to let 12 people who know nothing about the law sit there and decide whether that lawyer is going to be guilty, going to be held responsible for three times whatever that judgment was against his client, and whatever three times what the client thought the judgment should be for him, just because he exercised his very best judgment? How do we deal with that?
Well, in the first place, I don't think that this court necessarily, by holding an implied warranty for services, necessarily has to base all of that on Deceptive Trade Practices Act, or necessarily hold the treble damages. And as we know, under Deceptive Trade Practices Act, now there are more things than just a breach of warranty that give rise to treble damages. So let me put the treble damages aside, if I might.
But if we get into a warranty situation, the DTPA covers all warranties.
Okay, but let's put the treble damages aside, because my understanding is in most instances you've got to have a knowing finding and things of that nature, some basis other than simply a breach of warranty. And so let's limit the court's question to simply what is the vice in saying that implied warranties should extend to professionals? I have a hard time understanding the concern that people have about this, because the state has recognized that there are professionals, there are trades, there are craftsmen that can so affect the welfare, the health, the safety, the personal fortunes of all of us, that the state has said that we won't let you do that unless you have a license. And before you can have a license, you have to show minimum competency. Now, that act by the state alone shows me that the state has a legitimate interest in ensuring a minimum of performance. Now, what is an implied warranty but a theory by which we say there is a minimum of performance? If you take on a job, if I take on a lawsuit, and I have, for example, it's a complex malpractice case, and it comes to me, and it's one of the most complex, and I've never tried a malpractice case, I've never attended a malpractice seminar, I've never been in a courthouse, maybe I've never tried a lawsuit, and I tell my client I'm competent to handle that. And your honors knows that goes on. It goes on, unfortunately, and doesn't speak well of our profession.
Not on the big case.
Your honor?
Not on the big case.
All right. But if that were to happen, shouldn't that lawyer that does that be held to a minimum of professional standard? That is, since he says that he told the client, I'll take on your case, that he ought to carry it out in accordance with good and workmanlike manner.
But how do you distinguish that? Now, I hear you what you're saying, and I think that is an admirable objective. But how do you write a rule of law that will distinguish what you're talking about from the criminal case where the lawyer elects not to put the defendant on the stand, or any case where you elect not to cross-examine a witness, or the case to which Justice Wallace made reference a moment ago where you elect not to question the damages in the case and go after another aspect. How do you distinguish what you're talking about from those three hypotheses?
In other words, what is the difference between a warranty of workmanlike manner and simple negligence?
Well, the difference is because of the way they work. One of the problems, and I feel in my own mind, I may be wrong about this, that there are members of this court that are still disturbed about Dennis versus Alice. That's a case where, as the court recalls, a psychiatrist sexually abused his patient. Got her in a confidential situation, sexually abused her. Now, the plaintiff was in a real situation there. He couldn't very well say that it was negligent. When you have sexual contact, it's very seldom an accident or by negligent or carelessly done. It was pretty intentional. But it certainly was a breach of his ethical duties to her. And yet this court, in Dennis versus Allison, refused to recognize the duty of a psychiatrist to perform in keeping with ethical principles. If you want a rule to be fashioned, I think one place to start would be to say certainly the professional is obligated to follow his professional ethics at a minimum. At a minimum, we ought to have a rule that says that we have an implied warranty that a professional will adhere to our ethical standards. That'd be a simple rule. What'd be wrong with that?
You're saying overrule Dennis versus Allison.
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
And to reach the result that you want, we would have to do that.
Your Honor, I don't want to use all Mr. DeBow's time. I want to turn it over to him. But in conclusion, let me just say this in overruling Dennis versus Allison. I want to remind the court of the words of Jonathan Swift, who is a lot of court members may read as I do from time to time. And Jonathan Swift said, a man should never be ashamed to admit his mistakes, which is but saying, in other words, that he is wiser today than he was yesterday. So that's all I have to say about Dennis versus Allison. Thank you very much.
We filled all the time talking about lawyers and doctors. Do you want to talk about horse trainers?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. That's exactly what I'm here to do. May it please the court. My name is Kevin DeBose, and I also represent the petitioner in this case, Mr. John C. Archibald. I agree with Mr. Perdue that the time has come for this court to extend the implied warranty of good and workmanlike performance to all services and to expressly overrule Dennis versus Alice. However, in response to Justice Gonzalez's question, it is not necessary for the court to overrule Dennis versus Allison in order for the petitioner to prevail in this case. If this court does not want to overrule Dennis versus Allison and is reluctant to extend the implied warranty to all services, the logical place to draw the line is the distinction between professional and non-professional services. This court has suggested that through its questions this morning, through its opinion in Melody Holmes, which said we reserve the question of professional services. And this is what the Court of Appeals did in this case, because the Court of Appeals said there is no implied warranty for professional services. Therefore, the appellant loses. What the Court of Appeals did not do, and what this court needs to do, and what I want to talk about this morning, is how you distinguish between professional and non-professional services. Now, both parties to this appeal have suggested definitions of a professional in the briefs. I want to look at both of those definitions, both in a conceptual context and also in the context of the facts of this case. In our brief, we have suggested that a professional should be defined by three criteria: the obtainment of advanced formal education, licensing by the state, and internal regulatory procedures, which are often monitored through the state as well. Now, that definition makes some sense for several reasons, in both in terms of common ordinary usage of the term, in terms of the case law, and in terms of the statutes of this case. Now, I confess that in approaching this problem of how to define professional services, I felt somewhat like Justice Stevens must have felt in his famous definition of pornography when he said, "I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it." I think we all have a gut sense of what is a professional. And what I did was to make a list of the occupations that have traditionally been considered to be professional, which I think includes doctors, lawyers, dentists, CPAs, engineers, architects, and looked at the common traits of those professions. And the three traits that all of those occupations have in common is that they all require some advanced formal education, they all require a licensing by the state, and they all have internal regulatory procedures. And for that reason, I think that definition makes some sense.
What about plumbers? The chemists, plumbers?
I don't think plumbers are professionals. Plumbers don't have any requirement of advanced education. They are required to be licensed by the state, just as barbers are and exterminators.
They have to be a barber has to have 1,000 hours, isn't it, or 1,500 hours of education before he can be licensed?
That's true, Your Honor.
A plumber has to be an apprentice for, 2 years before he... that not advanced education?
Not in the same sense to doctors and lawyers and architects and engineers.
Yeah, but I want you to define that same sense.
All right. If a formal advanced education, I mean college degrees and in most instances graduate degrees in a specialty field.
And chiropractors fall in that category of profession? Though?
Chiropractors probably would fall in that category. I think so, Your Honor. The cases that have been cited by Act III Arabians in their brief on this question all apply to professions that meet these criteria. They all involve architects, lawyers, engineers, doctors. The three Texas cases cited are Dennis versus Allison, which was a psychiatrist, Barbie versus Rogers, which was an optometrist, and Morgan Spear case, which involved an architect. The out-of-state cases cited by Act III Arabians also involve people that fall into these categories. One of the cases relied upon most heavily by Act III Arabians in their brief is the case of City of Mounds View. And in a quotation from that case cited in the respondent's brief, they refer to architects, doctors, engineers, and attorneys. That's the kind of people that fall within this category. In addition, if we look at the statutes of this state, there are two statutes that attempt to define what professional services are. These statutes are not cited in the brief, and I want to call the court's attention to these two statutes. One is Article 1528F of the Texas Revised Civil Statutes. That's the Professional Association Act, 1528F, and the Professional Services Procurement Act, which is Article 664-4, 664-4 of the Texas Revised Civil Statutes. The Professional Association Act, 1528F, defines professional service in this way. It says professional service means any type of personal service to the public which requires as a condition precedent to the rendering of such service the obtaining of a license, and license includes a license certificate of registration or any other evidence of the satisfaction of state requirements. In the Professional Services Procurement Act, the statute doesn't attempt to describe a professional, it just limits the examples of professionals. That case says that professional services shall mean those within the scope of the practice of accounting, architecture, optometry, medicine, or professional engineering. The reason why it makes sense to draw the line here in professionals and non-professionals and define professionals in this way for this purpose is that those professionals that have those three requirements, the public, general public already has some built-in protection against incompetent performance. Not just anybody can go into one of these businesses as a car mechanic can, for example. But in order to have these, enter one of these professions, you must have advanced formal education, licensing by the state, and abide by internal regulatory procedures. So the public already has some protection in these professional fields, and that what makes is why it makes some sense to draw the line at that point.
Counsel, you evaded the question, I think, a while ago about barbers. They meet all three of the requirements that you mentioned.
I don't.
Plumbers meet all three of the requirements if you consider their two-year apprenticeship to be advanced formal education.
I don't consider that to be advanced formal education, however, you're
well, maybe they
consider
they do.
Receiving a degree from a university. I mean, do you equate that with advanced formal education?
I do, Your Honor. And formal education, by that I mean apprenticeship, is not formal education. It's certainly education, but it's not formal education in terms of a university degree or an advanced graduate degree.
Since your time is off, most of that, I assume what you're asking to do is, us to do is fashion a relief that would extend implied warranty that services to non-professionals.
I'd like to extend it all services as an alternative to non-professionals and hold in this case that the horse trainer was not a professional.
The Court of Appeals called him professional, didn't they not?
The Court of Appeals did not address that question at all. They just said there is no implied warranty for professional services, therefore you lose. And I think the error they made is that they did not attempt to analyze whether or not a horse trainer was a professional.
Do you want to comment on the non-waiverability of any of these warranties in any situation?
Your Honor, as far as I know, that was resolved by this court in the Melody Holmes opinion.
Well, we're getting outside Melody Holmes, though. We're going to broaden the scope.
I agree with the court's opinion in Melody Holmes that there should be a warranty, and it should not be something that should be waived, because that is often waived to the detriment of the consumer who's not aware of the effects of the waiver. And I think the court's opinion in Melody Holmes is correct, and we should continue to follow that policy in terms of waiverability.
Question here is whether we're going to extend it, isn't that right?
That's right, Your Honor. Now, the definition of professional that has been offered by Act 3 Arabians in their brief is somewhat different. Their definition says that a professional is someone who renders basically mental or intellectual skills rather than physical labor, that those services are performed in the context of an unpredictable environment, and that those services are rendered unconnected to the sale or repair of goods. Now, I have two points to make about that definition. The first is that I don't think it accurately distinguishes between professionals and non-professionals, and the second point is that even if you accept that definition, the horse trainer in this case does not meet those criteria. Now, the first element of the definition suggested by Act 3 Arabians is the exercise of mental or intellectual skill rather than physical labor. That may be true of some professions, but I think one of the professions that almost anybody would recognize is a doctor is certainly a professional. And a doctor, particularly a surgeon or possibly a dentist, for example, the essence of what they're doing is a physical act, and it's not their mental or intellectual skill that makes a difference in those cases. So the definition is slightly inaccurate there. The requirement that it must be unconnected with the sale or repair of goods, that it be a pure service, I think is overbroad, because there are all types of occupations that fall in this category that I don't think of as professional. For example, a teenage aerobics instructor is not involved in the sale of goods. It's a pure service, but I don't think of that aerobics instructor as a professional. A disc jockey for a college radio station.
You're running about out of time, but let me see if I understand your argument. You're arguing to this court that you trusted your high-priced horse to an unprofessional trainer? Is that your argument?
Unprofessional in this sense, Your Honor. And I mean, to a certain extent, professional is sometimes used as an adjective to mean skilled or competent.
To an unskilled horse trainer? Is that what you're arguing?
No. No, it was a horse trainer that my client certainly assumed was a skilled horse trainer, and they were represented to be that way. However, in this case, that did not turn out to be the case.
Thank you, counsel. We will now hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, this is Bruce Bennett and Mr. Joe Reynolds will present argument for the respondent.
Your Honors, my name is Bruce Bennett. With me today is Mr. Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds tried the case, lawsuit, and I have been trying to help out on appeal. I want to address, first of all, the professional question before I go into my argument, because I think it's really a non-issue here. It's been judicially admitted for the purposes of this lawsuit by Mr. Archibald in his pleadings and at trial that we were professionals. He called us professionals in his pleading. He called us professionals throughout the trial. And on page 35 and 36 of our brief, we set out that. His definition of what is a professional, I think, is illiberal. It's reactionary. It penalizes people who weren't able to get a formal education, but through experience, they have attained skills in a profession that requires the exercise of mental labor and judgment.
Counsel, are you saying that by a person referring to himself or someone else as a professional, that makes him a professional?
No, Your Honor, but I think the test is he exercising mental labor or skill? Is he faced, with his situation and performing his service, is he faced with random and unpredictable factors? The evidence in this case shows that Sky Gray, the trainer in issue, was faced with random and unpredictable factors in training a horse. Horses are unpredictable animals. There are many different techniques to use to try to train an animal. You have to make the judgment call which technique to apply, how long to apply it, when to switch.
Would you agree with me that a person many times uses the term professional to mean that he's getting paid for doing it?
That
Such
could
as
be,
professional football players?
That could be
professional
right.
Professional athletes of all kinds?
That sometimes professional is used as a descriptive term. But my point to you, Judge, is in this case, the evidence establishes that Sky Gray was a true professional in that he exercised constantly. He had to make judgment calls on what techniques to be used, how long to use them, and many, many different situations in dealing with horses. Horses have, like people, they have personalities. This is all in the record. And he is in the same situation as a lawyer who, in the stress of battle, has to decide whether or not he's going to cross-examine a witness, whether or not he's going to put on damages testimony if he's the defendant or not. Sky Gray was faced with the same judgment call. He's in the heat of battle trying to train the horse, trying to figure out what to do with the horse, how to make that horse into an Arabian show horse. He was faced with the same things that lawyers and doctors and architects and engineers are faced with when they have a random, unpredictable environment they're trying to deal with.
How do we know when a horse trainer gets to be a professional? Does he have to do this kind of work for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? Who tells him he's a professional?
I think in this case, the record in this case shows that Sky Gray and the Gray family were members of the American Horse Show Association, the International Arabian Horse Show Association, which are regulatory bodies to which they belong. Sky Gray had trained, I think, over 100 horses.
But isn't it kind of like the American Bar Association? They send you a bill and you send them the money and you become a member?
No, sir, it's not. And in fact, Archibald filed a complaint with one of these regulatory bodies in there. I believe there's been a hearing and a proceeding to disbar Sky Gray, to never let him train horses again. This is in the record. I appreciate they were not here at the trial, in the trial, and may not know that, but I mean, I read the record, and I expect them to, too. And it's in the record. It's on page, again, page 35 and 36 of our brief.
Which of the elements that you've just enumerated don't apply to professional football player and the plumber?
I think the plumber, first of all, it's not the case, but I'll try. I'm not that, I know more about horse training.
Well, we're looking for a yeah. place to draw a line.
I think you have to draw a line.
We're looking for help.
Is it a routine or is it a mechanical act? I think that's one thing you can look at. It was not a routine or mechanical act when you're training a horse. They have variable elements there. much more than a professional football player, an old tackle like I was, who has to just go and try to block that man in front of him. And that's fairly routine and fairly mechanical, perhaps even for plumbers. There's not only so many ways to fix a pipe. And his mental skill and effort may not be the predominant factor. It may just be the dominating factor in what he's doing is just making sure he screws the pipe on or fixes the commode. I think that's one of the key things to account. That's what other courts in the other states, in cases we cite, have keyed in on. Is it routine or mechanical? Did that engineer or did that whoever you're talking about, did they just pull a stock supply, you know, just the regular supply of plans for a building? Or did they sit there and create a plan for a building in San Francisco that has earthquake problems or has watershed problems? You know, is the plumber just, did he just fail to screw on the pipe rod? That's not our case. We've got a guy who had to make a judgment call in a constantly changing environment. His skill was primarily and predominantly mental and intellectual as opposed to routine or mechanical. I think that's probably the key distinction that y'all should go out on. We've got that in our brief. Now, Your Honor, if I might, I would like to back up. Nobody's really talked about the procedural posture of this case. There were basically three sets of issues submitted to the jury. The first was the failure to train issue. The jury found that Act 3 Arabians, our clients, were negligent, but their negligence in training the horse was not a proximate cause of the injury to the horse. It was not a foreseeable consequence that having this horse and riding the horse in that training session would lead over a month later to a founder. Not foreseeable. No negligence. They did find, however, though, that there a breach of an alleged implied warranty occurred, but that it was not a knowing breach. That Sky Gray did not knowingly breach of this warranty, and they found the value of the horse was $75,000. The jury had another set of issues, though. Failure to care for the horse. The jury found that Act 3 was not negligent in caring for the horse, and that there was no breach of this alleged warranty in caring for the horse. The jury further found that Mr. Archibald assumed the risk of a fatal training injury by signing a training agreement in which he disclaimed any warranties. Now, that's what the jury found. Judge Phillips was the trial judge. And he looked at those findings and decided that he rendered judgment for us because there was, under Texas law, no implied warranty given by providers of purely personal services, such as Sky Grove. The Court of Appeals was presented with the issue of the breach of warranty as a failure to train and some sufficiency points on the assumption of risk issues. Archibald did not appeal the findings that Sky Grove did not knowingly breach this warranty, nor did it appeal the failure to find proximate cause. And the Court of Appeals affirmed, again, agreeing with Judge Phillips, that under Texas law, there was no good and workmanlike warranty given by a professional, citing Dennis versus Allison.
Well, what were the points of error in the Court of Appeals?
The points of error, Your Honor, were that the trial judge should have rendered a judgment for the plaintiff based on the breach of the implied warranty and failure to train the horse. He had points saying that there was insufficient evidence to support the jury's finding that Mr. Archibald assumed the risk and that he signed the training agreement. That was basically all they appealed. They did not appeal the proximate causation issue or the refusal to find on the other warranty issues.
Did the Court of Appeals address those insufficiency points?
No, they did not. They said, since we find that there was no implied warranty in this case, we do not reach those points. We also had a cross point on the sufficiency of the evidence to support the value of the horse as found by the jury. Now, what the
Are court... Are you saying that scienter ought to be an element, even if we did go to implied warranty services?
Your Honor, I'm going to let Mr. Reynolds address that. He is prepared to talk about that, and I'm just going to defer to him on that subject. what the Court of Appeals said was, look, there are plenty of theories of relief here. You've got a breach of contract action that was not even pursued. It was neither pleaded nor submitted to the jury. You had a negligence cause of action. They just failed to prove one element. We say in our brief they even had an unconscionability cause of action under the DTPA. If they felt that the services were worthless, it could have been an unconscionable course of action. That was not pursued. There was an unconscionability issue, but was it unconscionable to require Archibald to sign a training agreement. Court of Appeals felt there were adequate theories of recovery here, and based on Dennis versus Allison, they affirmed. Now, Dennis versus Allison should not be overruled. It controls. Dennis versus Allison points out, I believe correctly, that a warranty is a guarantee, and Mr. Perdue agreed that today. He says, yes, it's a guarantee of performance. Well, what does it guarantee? An error-free performance is what you're guaranteeing. That is, implied warranty is a strict liability concept, and I think Mr. Perdue has recognized that. And it is a guarantee. That's what this court and Dennis said. It's a strict liability concept. It's not negligence. There's no foreseeability required.
Are any of y'all going to talk to us about the difference between a negligence standard and a breach of warranty standard?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm getting to that. Okay. I think that there is a difference. I think Justice Spears' concurring opinion and Bennett Colson points out that there is a difference. Now, I know the majority said we're basically going to equate negligence with this breach of warranty, but I think giving warranty its true meaning under Texas law as a guarantee, that it does mean something more than negligence. Justice Spears said you can exercise ordinary care, ordinary prudence, perform reasonably, and through a mistake, you can breach this warranty. That's what we're faced with here, Your Honors. That's what they're asking you to do, is put that on the backs of the
professional. Okay, but negligence professional is one who does something that the ordinary prudent professional would not do, or fails to do something the ordinary prudent professional would do. How does that differ from... If that's not the standard, then where do you breach your warranty?
I think the warranty is if you make a mistake during the course of performance, the jury's going to see that a mistake was made. They can find the mistake was made, and they're going to see that what the end result was. They're going to say the warranty was breached. It's a guarantee of an error-free performance. Negligence doesn't come into it. It doesn't matter that you couldn't foresee that some adverse consequence would result. Foreseeability's not in there. I think that's probably the biggest issue is we malpractice cases, the doctors, the lawyers, the defendants have the foreseeability. The law, I think, heretofore has wisely recognized that in rendering services in an area of an inexact science, mental error is inescapable. Judgment calls are going to be made. The professional can use his best efforts. He's making the best judgment call he can make after he's appreciated all the random factors. And if he makes a mistake, he's done. I hear Mr. Reynolds telling me it's time to let him take over, and I will do so at this time. Thank you.
Please, the court. I feel like an old war horse is just chomping to get out here and talk about this. I would like to say in the very beginning that Judge Phillips and I were the only ones here in this courtroom that participated in the trial of this case, and it was a fun case. And I think I enjoyed it most because maybe I'm just an urban cowboy at heart. But with all due deference to my friend Jim Perdue, I'd like to speak for the common man and maybe get back in his graces. I believe what we're doing here is missing the picture. As I understand petitioner, they're arguing to you, let's penalize this old boy that's the common man, but let's leave the professional out here by himself. I can't buy that. I've got to talk a minute about that other lawyer in that other case. I never thought I'd be on his side of anything, but I've got to talk about that a minute because it's a clear demonstration of what our problem is. First of all, the other lawyer in that case sat there in front of that jury for weeks. He analyzed that jury. He knew what he was doing. He was an experienced lawyer. He had tried case after case after case. His method and his system had worked for him. And then at a point in time, he had to make a judgment. His judgment was that he was not going to offer any evidence on damages. And in hindsight, with 20/20 vision, we see he made an error. And let me tell you what kind of an error it was. It was an honest mistake. Honest mistake. This to me is one of the limitations on what I think you're searching, at least what I'm searching to find an answer for. If you walk the streets of Houston today, you'll find half of the lawyers saying, man, he should have known better than to have done that. That was a mistake. Not that he guaranteed the result, no. But in the exercise and the performance of his job, he made a mistake. And if we buy what the petitioner is saying in this case, we are lowering the boom on every lawyer who makes a mistake of judgment, an honest mistake of judgment, in the trial of their lawsuit. Let me say, I have given a great deal of thought about this. Frankly, I would hope the court sees no need to change our time-honored rules of negligence. I think, in Judge Ray's opinion, and Dennis, I agree with him on trying to find a solution for a very terrible situation. I would have done it differently from that lawyer. I think that psychiatrist had liability because his conduct was unconscionable, and there is a remedy, a specific remedy in the Defective Trade Practice Act to cover unconscionable conduct. And that's where that case should have rested. And had Dennis been tried on that theory, that man would have got his just due.
We've already recognized in DeBakey versus Stagg that the ATPA extends to unconscionable conduct by lawyers.
Absolutely. And I think that gives a remedy in those sort of situations. I believe that what petitioner is suggesting here will create a cure that is worse than the disease. If the authority of a good workman like Manor for personal services, and I'm not